It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 69 for the 29th of March 2012. With a little over 20 years until the Earth is potentially destroyed by a giant asteroid, one UK university has a cunning plan to save our bacon, and indeed all meats, with a fleet of laser-mounted spaceships. Cameron has been in hot water again, only this time it's James, not David. The Avatar and Titanic director has become the first solo diver to explore a particularly murky part of the seas. And as UK games retailer Game enters administration after a turbulent battle with poor trading, we ask the question, what's the point of high street stores in the 21st century? All that and more coming up. Hoi hoi, Nate Langson here, editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me, of course, news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello.
And our associate editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
Back in the house altogether
after
Indeed. 3 weeks, 2 weeks. But we're also joined by the ineffable Dan Smith.
Good afternoon, Nate. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Dan is our powerful intern, been with us for 6 months, and he's about to leave. So we dragged him onto the show to talk about all the things we're talking about today, which is quite cool. Actually, you know what? A total side tangent here. I got sent a game this afternoon called Stone Quarry Simulator. Is that not the most thrilling title for a game you've ever heard?
What does it simulate? The whole process of quarrying?
Yes, particularly in the variety of stones. Yeah. Stone Quarry Simulator.
What's the jeopardy in that situation? That a stone might fall on top of your...
Yeah, but these things simulate...
Well, you might not dig out enough in time.
Disaster.
Massive machines these things simulate. Anyway, that's my weekend set. Let's get on with some news. James Cameron, Liv, he's sunk.
He's sunk sort of to very deep depths. That's obviously the Avatar, director of Avatar. He's become the first solo diver to explore the Mariana Trench, which is in the Pacific Ocean. It's 10 kilometres or more than 10 kilometres below sea level. And he went down there in a tiny little torpedo-shaped submarine. I think it was 7 metres tall. And he descended to 10.91 kilometres below sea level.
Now, specifically, this is the deepest part in any of the world's oceans.
Yes, and it's deeper than Mount Everest is tall, to give a sense of scale.
Why did he do this? Is he just having a laugh?
He's just having the lols. No, he wants to create a documentary about what he finds under there. There's all sorts of really strange creatures that have evolved that live down at these depths, and he wants to document them.
I think it would be amazing if you could see one of these videos, if it becomes a documentary in 3D. Because, I mean, he's doing all this stuff with 3D. He did Avatar. He's, you know, retrofitted Titanic in 3D. I think this would be one of the most incredible things to actually see in 3D.
It really would be.
But how much is there to actually see down there? Surely it's just a kind of abyssal plain at the bottom, and it's just flat, well, mostly flat, with a few things scuttling around.
Well, I think there's lots of very weird creatures that have kind of evolved down there, especially by the hydrothermal vents. I think there's some kind of worm-type creatures that can withstand differences of temperature of 100 degrees at their head and at their foot, I was going to say, but they obviously don't have feet.
Yeah.
But these are creatures that can withstand like temperatures of more than 100 degrees Celsius. Yes, and it's. I think there's going to be some fascinating things to see. I don't know if you've ever watched any documentaries about deep sea.
I've read an awful lot about deep sea expeditions, though. I mean, there've been quite a few. Like they've done, I think, two men in a boat, and like kind of in the like decades ago.
this is only the second manned trip down to the Mariana Trench, and the first one was in 1960. It was a US Navy trip, and there were two men.
Jacques Picard, the Swiss oceanographer, right?
There was a Swiss oceanographer and a US Navy person.
Yeah.
And they went down there, had a poke around, but they got to the bottom, churned up so much sand and mud that they didn't really see very much, which would be a bit of a problem for Cameron if he wants to film down there.
Yeah, well, here's hoping that something comes out of this quite soon, because I'm all excited. By the way, this is what my joke at the start of the show meant. Hot waters, you know?
At the hydrothermal vents, there is very hot water, but yeah. I think, as Duncan pointed out, it's also extremely cold at the bottom.
I just wanted to explain.
I don't think that joke works. I don't think it is hot water down there. It's cold water.
But also, anyway, anyway, Cameron's not the only person who's trying to get down here. Also, Richard Branson and Eric Schmidt are also funding trips down to the bottom of the trench.
Virgin Oceanic. We talked about that a few months ago, I think, actually. Right, well, let's move on. Let's get out of the water and get back onto land with a little bit of 4G. There's been some hot water surrounding 4G this week, Duncan.
Would you stop it with the hot water?
No.
This is Ofcom delaying plans from Everything Everywhere to roll out 4G by the end of the year in the UK.
4G being the next evolution of our wireless internet services. We've got 3.5G at the moment. The next step is 4G. Does this mean, though, that we're not going to get 4G at all this year? Because, I mean, the iPad's being sold as a 4G device, even though we don't technically have 4G here.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. I mean, it's only a three-week delay, but that could be crucial because Everything Everywhere, which, as most of you will probably know, is the merger between T-Mobile and Orange, have been planning to use the extra spectrum that they got in that merger to create 4G services in Britain. But a lot of the other providers, O2 and Vodafone and so on, have complained about this, saying that they're going to have to wait until the next spectrum auction to launch their own 4G services. And so it will give Everything Everywhere a bonus, basically. The ability to sign up loads and loads of customers to a 4G service before they get the chance to do that.
But is this really anti-competitive? I mean, Liv, the fact that the merger went ahead, I mean, surely this can't be an abuse of...
Well, I guess I would have thought that was just kind of how business works. But I suppose if there's no way that the other companies can get access to the additional bandwidth, then maybe it is a bit of a problem. What I don't understand is how they got more bandwidth from the merger. Do they kind of get their economies of scale by merging
their
network?
Well, I mean, they only really need one network to run it all off, and they had two, if you see what I mean. So they'd have extra capacity on those networks. But what's interesting is that Ofcom reckons they've kind of made statements kind of towards the effect that the anti-competitive nature of this could be balanced out by the potential benefits to consumers of getting 4G earlier.
Yeah. Yeah,
such as the fact of maybe having 4G as an option to begin with.
Yes, you know. Absolutely. But that didn't stop Vodafone's CEO saying that Ofcom had taken leave of its senses, and O2 saying that it was completely contradictory to the objective of delivering a competitive market environment with four competing players. But yeah, as I say, it could mean that the original plan to roll it out before the end of 2012 is going to be delayed until the start of 2013.
I'm gutted by this, to be honest, because we've been reading about 4G for about 18 months.
I think it's important to put 4G into context of what it actually means, because at the moment there are much faster speeds that you can achieve in the UK than even what you can achieve on what's called 4G over in, say, the US. I mean, most of the networks now are either running or rolling out speeds of sort of over 20 megabits per second. And in certain parts of the US where they're being sold 4G, they're actually getting something like 11 or 12 megabits per second. So there is the real problem with, is this a marketing advantage by being able to say we're offering 4G, and as opposed to offering a real new set of competitive technologies. And to be perfectly honest, if you're on one of the, you know, particularly if you're in the cities, then you're already available on most networks to get extremely fast speeds. And I just don't think that people should be too hung up, even if we don't get 4G till next year, which a lot of the networks would say is basically when you should be looking to get it anyway. I think that it could be overstated that this is a problem.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that there's a big kind of discrepancy around the world in what's called 4G. The term is very, very poorly defined, and it can mean all kinds of things, from LTE, long-term evolution of existing 3G networks, or WiMAX. It can be used in lots and lots of different ways. So working out and standardizing what 4G is probably quite an important thing to be doing.
Liv, I want to move on to inflatable plugs. Now, this is something that you've been writing about this week, and
yes.
I was fascinated when I saw the headline, and even more fascinated when I edited the story. What's this all about?
What about when you came up with the plugs, not drugs?
Yes, plugs, not drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's move on.
Let's move on. Yeah, this is a project in the US from the Department of Homeland Security Science and Technology Directorate. God, that doesn't roll off the tongue too easily. To develop a 10-metre by 5-metre inflatable structure that could be quickly deployed and to kind of block off sections of a tunnel in a case of a flood or the release of chemical agents.
These have been in operation for a little while somewhere, haven't they?
They've been tested for a little while somewhere. They've been in operation in things like airbags in cars, but similar ilk of technology. But this is a huge, large-scale like tunnel plug that would be used to completely block off a tunnel and then be able to withstand the pressure of like water pushing against it on one side.
So if, say, the Channel Tunnel
sprung a giant leak. Yes. I mean, it leaks anyway to balance pressure, but if it did have a giant catastrophic leak, we could sort of blow one of these things up in the entranceway and send all the water down to France instead of
potentially
up the coast.
I'm not sure exactly whether it would work for something on the scale of as the Channel Tunnel, but possibly. But yes, you fill it up, it will completely seal the tunnel, and then you add water into it to make it heavier and more resistant.
Does this happen with kind of big air compression, or does it literally fly open like an airbag does?
It's a bit slower than an airbag. It's a large, large thing. I think it has 34,000 gallons of space inside it. But yes, and the reason why they created it was because in Chicago in 1992, an unused freight tunnel that had a little leak in it ended up flooding the entire system of tunnels under Chicago and caused $1.26 billion pounds in damages. And it took 6 weeks to sort out. So they're trying to prevent that sort of thing happening again.
It's one of those sort of technologies that can probably be quite easily shifted or airlifted around to emergency areas rather than needing to sort of roll in an actual giant physical cork, or what is ostensibly a cork.
Well, it's like a Zorb, isn't it?
A Zorb?
Mm. Yeah.
What's a Zorb?
You know those things that you get in and you wheel down a hill in, like a big hamster wheel for people, but they're inflatable.
They're inflatable, so you don't get hurt. Oh, I know those. Yeah, they're hilarious.
So you could do this, but obviously it's, you know, the size of a house rather than just a car.
Fun times. Let's go into space. Now, there are rumours, well, they're not rumours, it's fact, actually, that in 2036, it's been predicted by NASA, an asteroid with a diameter of 450 metres has a 1 in 250,000 chance of smacking Earth in the face. Now, this is obviously a concern because an asteroid of that size hitting us is going to cause quite considerable devastation. So, there are a number of projects underway that want to tackle such a scenario, and one of them has come out of the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow. And engineers there have come up with this idea that they think could be the solution, and it involves sending a flotilla of little spaceships up into space, each of which has a giant laser mounted onto the back of it. And when these asteroids come within too close to Earth, they could be blown up, essentially.
Does this mean that these university professors have already kind of outdone the Death Star? Have they kind of figured out that kind of single laser doesn't really work?
Well, in a way, I mean, there's no one living inside these things. It's you know, it's unmanned. But you raise a good point. The reason why they're not proposing one giant space-mounted laser is because a troop of little lasers is much, much more scalable. So these things have a tendency to not decompose, but kind of become less efficient over time as the laser gets used. And it's much more efficient to replace individual ones that have over time kind of worn out than it is to replace one giant one in one go.
And there's also an issue of space debris, right?
Yeah, I mean, space debris is kind of the other thing that this could tackle, which is there's a lot of, you know, bits of old plane and engine and rocket and old spacesuits kind of up in space. And there's increasingly a concern as we sort of, you know, launch more satellites and want to do more with space exploration. And this could be another way of tackling space debris in the future. But what's a problem, and this is still only a plan, it's not something that's actually being built yet. The problem is that it's actually very, very, very difficult to build a laser that's so high powered it can destroy asteroids and be precise enough and have a higher quality enough beam in space. Like, it's still a really you know, developmental technology that they're working with.
That was what I was going to say. We see a lot of these stories about lasers potentially either moving space junk or kind of it blowing it up. And I know that tools on things like Mars rovers do have little lasers that do tests on rocks and stuff. But have we seen, is there anything that exists already of any kind of scale that we could imagine would be able to develop to break up a 450 metre across?
On Earth, yes. In space, no. So there have been a lot of tests on Earth to basically blow planes out of the sky. But it's far easier to do that in, you know, Earth's atmosphere and with Earth's gravity than it is to kind of do it in space, particularly when you're trying to line up a number of these things.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think the biggest, well, not for me, I think one of the biggest obstacles to using lasers in space properly is getting the power up there. It's you know, most stuff is in space is designed to use as little power as possible because there isn't much in the way of power sources up there other than solar panels.
Well, that's actually
what you take with you.
That's exactly what this will be using. These will actually be solar powered. So, you know, they are going to take advantage of building up an energy boost by capturing the sun's rays and then sort of exploding that out in one giant go.
But so, will they actually be anything? Because it's 2036 that we're looking at. That seems like quite a very long time.
It is for that one particular asteroid. But there are asteroids that kind of come... Well, there are asteroids that do hit us, you know, very frequently. Or a lot of them, a lot of the larger ones kind of get sucked off by Jupiter because of its gravitational... thanks to its massive size and gravitational pull. But Duncan, let's land. I want to talk about atmospheric stuff, climate stuff specifically.
Yes.
The Met Office has been, well, I said crowdsourcing some atmospheric forecasting, but that's not even remotely accurate, is it?
you're not too far off. It's a project to try and eliminate some of the uncertainty involved in climate forecasts based on measurement inaccuracy.
There's a lot of confusion into climate forecast. It's pretty hard.
Yeah, it can be because we have sort of very we don't have an awful lot of data is basically the biggest problem. So what this experiment did, which was run on climateprediction.net, is it took data and a climate model supplied by the Met Office, and it sent it out to an enormous amount of computers across the world. It's a distributed computing project.
Home computers, weren't they?
Home computers, yes, exactly that. And they all ran the same model, but with ever so slightly different data each time.
Right, and what was the point of this? I mean, obviously there are so many types of climate model. Why was this particular experiment different and interesting?
Okay, so the reason they ran it 10,000 times with slightly different data is to minimize the effect of measurement errors. It's pretty much impossible to measure initial conditions in the atmosphere with 100% accuracy, and those errors will grow over time as the simulation progresses. A bit like the whole butterfly flapping its wings and then that little eddy
chaos
growing.
Theory, correct?
Yeah, and that little eddy growing into a bigger eddy, and that eddy going into a bigger eddy until it becomes a hurricane. And so if you've got a fake butterfly in your data somewhere, then you could get a fake hurricane out of it. So what they do is they run loads and loads and loads of simulations with initial conditions that are slightly tweaked in every direction, and by that you can kind of eliminate these minuscule little errors, because you can see which aspects of the forecast, when you look at all the results, are the least sensitive to measurement errors, which ones are the most likely to happen.
So this seems a lot like the Stanford University's Folding at Home project, sort of getting everyone's home computer to simulate a little bit of protein folding for you know, to basically compute these massive, massive challenges.
Yes, absolutely. In terms of the distributed computing aspect, yeah. But the kind of the interesting thing about this is that it's this process, which is called ensemble forecasting, is normally applied to just regular weather forecasting over the period of maybe a couple of weeks. This is one of the early attempts to use it in terms of climate forecasting instead. And what's interesting is that it has predicted actually quite stronger climate change than most other models do, or faster climate change anyway, an increase in global temperatures of between 1.4 and 3 degrees Celsius by 2050, whereas other more traditional climate models will predict that kind of range by the end of this century.
Cool, well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to answer the question, or at least try to answer the question, what's the point of the high street?
Wired magazine, published digitally every month on iPad. Now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
It was a sad week for high street games retailer Game as it filed for administration and appointed the PwC Group to be its administrators. It's been struggling with sales and profits for quite some time, and recently hit the news when it was unable to stock massive AAA titles like Mass Effect 3, which really called into question what is the future of Game. Including GameStation, the Game Group had over 1,000 stores and has been going for about 20 years or so since starting off. It was originally established as the Rhino Group in the early 90s. It's absorbed Virgin Games at one point, I think about 1993, 94, something like that. And, you know, had hitherto done fairly well. But it's kind of a sad story, because Game was such a big player in the UK game scene, and I think it came as a little bit of a shock when we found out that it was withdrawing itself from the London Stock Exchange, which I think was earlier this month, maybe only a week or so ago, and then eventually filed to enter administration. So I think the first thing to ask is, if Game is unable to make a comeback as a result of going into administration, will we really miss it? I mean, what's the point of a high street game store these days when the deals are so much better on
runs something like Amazon. Duncan, I'm asking you.
You're asking me. Well, I mean, I'm a sort of interesting person to ask this because I'm a PC gamer, and the PC games sphere has been long abandoned by the likes of Game. There'll be five ancient titles on budget in the back of the store somewhere on some dusty shelf, and the entirety of PC gamers have long shifted over to digital distribution and platforms like Steam. So I'm not going to miss it one bit.
Do you think it's a shame? Do you think it's not a shame, but do you think it's do you think Game could have maybe fared better if it had come up with its own games distribution system? I mean, Steam has done so well and has got so many publishers and indie developers and people on board that it's kind of become the de facto standard in PC game distribution and more recently on the Mac as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's entirely possible that if they'd invested in that kind of thing earlier enough, then yeah, they could have grown. But it's easy to say that with 2020. Hindsight, you know, at the time it would have been very, very difficult for that to be a proposal, and when they'd need to have done this, like, to start with, Steam was very poorly regarded by many gamers, and it's only recently, and by recently I mean kind of over the last 5 or 6 years, that it's become so incredibly important to PC games retail. But consoles are different.
Liv, do you still buy stuff from stores when it comes to, like, physical media? Because this is the big debate.
Media, no.
We're moving to digital distribution platforms across the board, not just Steam for games, but, you know, things like, obviously, MP3 downloads and things from iTunes and movies and Netflix and stuff.
I sometimes get Blu-ray movies, but that's probably about where it stops. And if I do get them, I'll buy them online anyway. So, you know, that's probably the only place I'd go.
In recent years, Game had made quite a big effort to push its pre-owned exchange program, which publishers absolutely despise, because although it's legal, it means that they don't get to make a second sale on a piece of game games media. And it's been a real problem they've been trying to tackle by putting things in like online passes. So if you buy a game new, you get to access the online features for free, but if you buy it pre-owned, you have to pay an extra £10 just to play that game online, even though you've done nothing illegal. It was one of the ways they were trying to combat this, and Game had a good system where you could go in and you could trade a game for, you know, trade it in against a brand new title or get cash, and then started selling off really good offers like 3 for 2 on pre-owned games, which was massively compelling. I mean, I've bought a number of games because of that.
I mean, one of Game's biggest problems was always the prices that it charged. It would put £50-60 price tags on new games when online you'd be able to get them for £35.
But is that a problem of Game? I mean, that seems to be symptomatic of all physical retail stores. I mean, we've seen
It is. But, I mean, that's still a problem, because consumers are only going to pay what they're willing to pay, and I don't think they were willing to pay £60 for brand new games, or in very rare cases anyway.
And the in-store experience was so unpleasant, or maybe mediocre, that there wasn't any interest in coming into the store as opposed to buying online, except perhaps if you were, as we've said in the article, granny or mum or dad who doesn't play games and might want to talk to someone.
That's the thing. These stores have been great for, you know, 82-year-old Grandma Jones to go into a store and say, I want to buy a game for my grandson for his 18th birthday. What shall I buy? And they've sort of been able to point this out. But, you know, is that enough to keep a store in business? I mean, the answer is no, it wasn't. But
I think what we've kind of got from the feedback from our readers and also from us as well, like, the experience needs to be something new. They need to push the social angle. They need to have competitions, and they need to just get people in there having fun, right?
Yeah, so I mean, would that be a solution? I mean, if Game came back and said, we're going to offer in-game multiplayer sessions, I mean,
well, that's something that some of our readers say. Should we read out some of the feedback?
Yeah,
we got
some good feedback on this.
Ryan Bilow, I don't know how to pronounce his
name.
Ryan, really sorry, said, I'd like to see Game rescued, but it would need a massive overhaul. The high street shop in its current model simply can't compete with online shops with their massively reduced overheads. The only way to make it successful again is to reinvent what it is. Sell games, but it has to sell the social, human, interactive side of it that you can't get from online. You can make it a cafe, hold regular tournaments for gamers, make it a place that gamers actually want to hang out, with software sales as an aside.
That's a good point, but I mean, we've seen internet cafes and kind of gaming services where they've had these LAN parties in a store. I mean, they're not exactly around every corner anymore. You see cyber cafes, you know, an hour of internet for 9p, but they're not playing the latest Halo games.
I don't think that's actually necessarily true. I think there are quite a lot of cyber cafes across the UK that are doing very, very well, especially when it comes to kind of more hardcore esports sort of titles like StarCraft and Counter-Strike and things like that.
But there's not a big enough market for
that's
this
not a mainstream,
for 1,000
certainly.
Stores.
But I think the point that Ryan is making, and that I'd like to make as well, is that kind of, if that experience was brought to the high street audience, I don't think they'd go, oh my God, no, I don't want to play that. They'd be interested and they might get involved in it and they might sell more games as a result.
Yeah. I think what's also been interesting is that while Game has been trying to make itself kind of a place to go for pre-owned games, so has the online retailer Amazon, that has obviously been a big burden for the high street. And they have been offering pre-owned exchange. So you could actually send in by free post your old games and then not just exchange it for games or a book or something as you would in Game, but exchange maybe five games for 25 quid, 30 quid of credit and buy a new blender. You know, and I think that is so attractive for consumers. If you
blenders.
Can just...
Yeah, consumers love blenders.
Well, you know what I mean? I mean, if you could, if you had the option of going into a game store and saying, okay, we're going to give you trade-in and we're actually going to let you spend it against MP3 downloads or against a new Mac, I mean, the Game literally cannot compete with that without selling everything.
One of our readers, Minkus Q. Minkerson, if that is his real name, does slightly disagree with you there. He says that he thinks that they actually need to wean themselves off the over-reliance on the second-hand market, on spending all that shelf space on these second-hand games, which makes it much harder for them to compete with supermarkets and other kind of high street retail presences that aren't exclusively dedicated to games on choice, which is what they really need to do.
And supermarkets have been battling this for ages. Well, they've been selling top-tier titles for a massive markdown just to get people into the stores, and really, that's probably the main reason why Game has gone out. Amazon has been around for years now. It's the supermarkets really pushing video games as a new way of getting people into stores that I think has had the most, or possibly had the most effect.
I think they need to... I very much agree with Ryan in that Game needs to reinvent itself, if it does get to reinvent himself. I think the Royal Bank of Scotland has potentially put in a bid. And as a side note, would that mean that we all sort of slightly own Game because we all own the Bank of Scotland?
That's a great question.
Probably one that none of us here can answer
right now. But anyway, they need to kind of immerse themselves into offering the kind of culture around gaming and the ability for people to relax in an environment that includes games, and then have the desperate selling as a secondary point.
So I think to answer the question, what is the point of the high street? I think there is still a need there, but stores like Game need to reinvent themselves, not just to be a retailer, but to be providing the kind of services that has basically gone to online discussion, advice, and online gaming.
A great parallel would be a record store like Rough Trade East, which still exists and does incredibly well today by offering like live gigs in the store and coffee and various other things. And if you start offering gamers other stuff alongside just boxes of games, they'll buy it.
Well, hope it goes well. We will miss Game. It's been a staple of my game buying experience for a little while. So, you know, it's always sad to see jobs go over something like this. Let us know what you think, though. podcast@wired.co.uk. And, of course, on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wiredUK. And on that note, we are going to transition into this week's uber exciting feature. As questions are raised as to whether the UK is going to meet its environmental targets as set by the EU by 2020, certain firms and companies are investigating ways to help the process. One of these is Kinetic, based down in Farnborough, and they've got some fascinating research projects and engineering works going on. And Katie, Scott, hello.
Hello.
You've been trotting around their facility and finding out some pretty amazing stuff. What the hell is going on with Kinetic? Who are they? What do they do?
Well, Kinetic are basically a huge company that have a vast array of R&D facilities across the country. The one I went to see was in Farnborough. And they're doing everything from testing the new Boeing engine through to working on this pyrolysis plant, which I went to visit.
And they're ex-military, right?
They are. They're kind of a military spin-off, but they still have maintained their connections with the military. So often the military will come to them with a problem and Kinetic will solve it.
Okay, and what are they working on right now? What's the most interesting thing?
Well, I mean, they're working on lots of interesting, exciting things, some of which I wasn't allowed to see. But the thing that I went to see was this plant that basically turns 5 tons of rubbish a day into electricity and heat. What's exciting is that this machine could basically be used to clear landfill sites.
Okay, and you spoke to someone about this?
I did. I spoke to a couple of people, actually, while I was down at Kinetic. I spoke to Peter Horsted, who's the delivery lead on the project, as well as John Riley, who's MD of the whole thing. I talked to them specifically about the pilot program that they're currently running. But first of all, I got Peter to just explain to me what the plant actually does.
Well, the technology is based on pyrolysis. We feed the waste into a hot zone. As the waste drops down into a vertical zone, it gets hotter. we take out the oxygen, so we pyrolyze the waste, so there's no combustion. That degrading of the waste turns it into a charcoal, which comes out the bottom of the plant, and then that liberates fuel gases. Those gases we export for energy, in this case is feeding hot water, and a small amount of that gas is recycled round to process the next batch of waste. So once up into temperature, it is self-sustaining.
It was, in fact, a logistical challenge being faced by the British military that got Kinetic onto pyrolysis technology in the very first place.
The military were having problems with their waste management in a restricted area like the Gulf, and they were actually losing operational capability through having to store the waste in flight decks and in hangars. So we took on a research project to look into what technologies would be available and suitable for putting on board large ships, large aircraft carriers. The solution we found was obviously based on pyrolysis, but we also looked at incineration and other forms of degrading the waste. What the benefits of pyrolysis over incineration, it's very clean. We're exporting a gas and burning that gas in a very controlled manner, very similar to burning a fossil fuel, where incineration is very much a bonfire in a box, and it actually uses energy to process the waste.
It's worth adding at this point that Kinetic has also delivered a 100 kilogram energy for waste system to the US Army.
The pilot program in the UK is basically to prove suitability for commercial ventures, either like private companies or things like the NHS.
Yeah, I mean, what they're arguing is that the system works for the military, and it could work for, you know, big companies like supermarkets or the NHS, so that basically you have these plants on site and they're getting rid of the rubbish on site.
It's been about 9 months since we got the go-ahead to build a plant here. We're currently in a three-month commissioning program, which is due to end end of June, July time. So we've got about another 2 months of commissioning, and then it will go live, and it will actually process the site's waste here and export the energy.
And the pilot plant, along with the existing working plants being used by the military, have given Kinetic the figures they're now using when talking to everyone from Vince Cable, who was a recent visitor to the pilot programme, to supermarket chain management.
250 kilograms of waste were exporting about 750 kilowatts of heat energy into our recirculating hot water here. It would be able to heat around about 300 homes, or on this site we're using it to cope with about 25% of our hot water capacity.
So alongside keeping the employees at Kinetic warm and with hot water this coming winter, what's next for the pyrolysis plant and the pilot programme?
We're looking to build three new plants for three different sectors. One for health, which is hospitals, large hospitals. One retail, could be Tesco, Sainsbury's, that kind of company, and one kind of facilities management, more like an Amy, Balfour Beatty type company. So we're going to test three markets.
So what happens to the waste?
Well, basically at the moment, the plant produces this charcoal, and by the time these three new plants are operational, then Kinetic will have uses mapped out for this charcoal, and so they'll be able to go to clients and say, when you've got the charcoal produced, you need to contact these people, and they will take the charcoal off your hands. And Peter mentioned just one of the uses, and that's a filter for contaminated soil. The big thing for Kinetic is they think this could have a huge impact on the waste problem that we have in the UK, even to the point where landfills have to be mined for more rubbish to feed the plants. And that means that we might meet these 2020 EU goals.
Pretty cool stuff, Katie. What was your highlight of the day? The single one biggest thing? The coolest thing?
Well, I mean, I know waste doesn't sound a particularly exciting subject, but what was pretty cool for me was just seeing the vast amount of rubbish that actually goes into this machine. And this is stuff that can't be recycled. And, you know, what little comes out of it. And also the fact that this machine, which isn't huge, looks like something out of it's a Victorian steampunk machine. So that was pretty cool as well. I felt slightly like I was sort of in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but obviously waste and not sweets.
Thanks, Katie. And that is, of course, going to draw a line under this week's chapter of Wired News. And we're going to draw a new line. It's going to be all about getting in touch. Liv, how can people follow this line and get in touch?
Drop us a line.
Yes. Yes. I like that.
First of all, you can give us a call. We're on 0208 123 0468. Call us from a landline or a mobile, and you can leave us a message up to 30 seconds, and we will play it in the show.
Yep. And follow us on Twitter. We are at Wired UK, of course, and we are facebook.com/WiredUK if you want to go and get involved in our kind of little Wired fan club. It's a very community-led spirit over there, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's where we tend to kind of ask people for the reactions that we read out on the game story earlier. We'll ask people on Facebook that, and then...
You get to see a bit behind the scenes, get to see Duncan's fantastic t-shirt. Unicorns bursting out of the galaxy, horses chasing it, wearing headphones. I mean, it's the most audacious piece of t-shirt engineering I've ever seen.
So if that sounds appealing, then facebook.com/wiredUK.
Yep, and email us podcast@wired.co.uk, of course. Dan, thank you very much for being the man and joining us in the hut.
Thank you. The hut is very hospitable. I've had a very nice time. Thanks a lot.
Good. Awesome. And we'll see you again next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
What do you think about Duncan's new t-shirt, by the way?
I bloody love it.
Unicorns flying through space, wearing headphones. Very hipster.